Good morning. Well, at least it is for me. My name is Sylvain Chamberlain. I took my vows as a Buddhist monk in 1988, so I've been studying Buddhism for 27 years. Everything I'm talking about in these videos and what I'm going to start to tackle today is a result of my study, meditation, advice, mostly study, and Buddhism is that, it's mostly study. I have a deep appreciation in my own life for scholarship in anything that I tackle. I am a Nichiren school Buddhist, but I don't belong to any particular Nichiren sect, because I have a love of science and mathematics, and my discovery that Buddhism and quantum are different languages about essentially the same thing, I label, if we need a label, my particular teachings, or my elucidation on the teachings, the quantum life school of Buddhism. But it is a Nichiren lineage. By that I mean, you know, the Buddha taught over 50 years of his lifespan, and he taught to the capacity and the time of the people he was dealing with, which means, kind of like when we go to school, we learn in stages. We don't first hear about math and then dive into physics. We learn how to add and subtract, and we do our multiplication tables. We learn how to divide, and then we learn about fractions, then we learn about algebra, and so on. Buddhism was taught in much the same way. And there's a tremendous amount of scholarship throughout the last 2,500 years about, and this is one of the things I find fascinating and wonderful about Buddhism, is that it's not a static, there's no deification, there's no just believe it without evidence. Buddhism is a study of reality and what's observable as fact. And it's a deep concentration on the nature of things, of everything. Lucretius did the same thing in Greece and came to some very similar conclusions. The reason I say all this is because you'll hear about the Pali Canon, or the Theravada school, or the Visipana school. These are all chunks along the way of the teachings of Buddha. In other words, it would be very similar to saying, well, once I learned algebra, I didn't need to learn any more math. I got it. Once I got to algebra, I understood math. Which is unfortunate, because you're missing out on a much greater, bigger picture, that once you get past algebra and geometry into trigonometry and then physics and then calculus, well, that's a whole nother school, because it built upon the earlier teachings. It didn't invalidate them. If it invalidated anything, was that what you thought were absolute truths here are actually mutable, and there are new things to shoot for here, until you get to the ultimate teachings that he taught in the last 8 years of his life. This is not my opinion, although I agree with it. I follow the scholarship through Nagarjuna, who was a tremendous, he really dug into certain just specific concepts of Buddhism, specifically Anatman in the Majjhimika, talking about self and the nature of self and no self. And then there's Vasubandhu, who later on in our millennium said, elucidated a great deal about the nature of the composite elements that make up a human being, in the view of Buddhist science, really. Then there was the great reorganizing in the 6th century by Qi or Qiche or Tendai, who went through all these teachings that were going all over Asia and everywhere, and saw that some of them were being diluted by for power reasons and emperors and so forth, and cut away the stuff that wasn't essential Buddhist teachings, and put to get formalized a very clear structure of how the Buddhists taught in stages, and you could identify which suttas or sutras belonged to which stage. And then following him, people like Saicho and Dengyo, all the way up to Nichiren. These are tremendously involved scholars who desperately wanted to understand to the nth degree what the Buddha was saying, so that there could be no misconception, no extraneous ideas that would float in and influence the crucial knowledge and observation that the Buddha made. So having said all that, that's why the lineage is important, and that's why I want to tell you up front that I'm a Nichiren School Buddhist, and when I say that, I'm invoking that lineage all the way back to the actual man, Siddhartha, the Buddha, the living Buddha, or the historical Buddha, if you will. All right, so all that out of the way, what I want to start to tackle is many things, because they're all interrelated, but I'm going to try to start small, because all of this in Buddhism, everything builds and builds and builds, just like I was explaining math. I hear the word compassion all the time. I hear you, I'm sure you've heard it all your life. And language is a funny thing. It mutates to the service of whoever is using it. Very basically, compassion, maybe not basically, maybe you have a different impression of what this means, but compassion generally is having empathy or empathetic feelings or consideration for the situation others around us are in. And that sounds simple enough. It gets diluted, well, I feel sorry for you. But that's not really compassion. So that's why I thought, let me take that apart today and let's talk about that. And that will lead us into a broader discussion about the 3,000 realms in a single thought moment. And a very, very deep understanding of the nature of things and how our mind works, a critical component of the ultimate teachings of Buddha, which are contained in the Lotus Sutra. But again, everything in Buddhism is a guide. There's no assertion in Buddhism that this is it. There's only the assertion that this is the way. Buddhism is about a way to get to the truth. And the reason for that is, let's talk about feelings for a moment. I hear people saying, well, you hurt my feelings. I got my feelings hurt. Where do feelings come from? And why do they get hurt? First off, let me say that nobody can hurt your feelings. Nobody. Your feelings arise within your mind, and they're completely yours. And if they arise with a compound, which we'll get into, of things that make you feel bad in some way, that's yours to control. That's nobody else's. There may be people who will say things and you will take them. You know the saying, take offense? It really means that you're taking it. And it's not being given to you. You're taking it. You're taking something that hurts you, which is something that's happening completely within yourself, and you're building your reality around it, and then you're wanting to spew out in some sort of defense or justification, whatever it be. And what we're really talking about, I think you've already identified it, if you understand the feelings are all yours, that nobody can do anything to them except you, what we're talking about is our ego. And ego is an interesting thing. Ego is another word for the self that we look at in the mirror every day, or that we picture in our minds, that is what we are, our identity. Whenever we say, this is me, or that's mine, or this is how I feel, or my feelings got hurt, or I feel this way, or this makes me mad, the making is yours. And it's all based on this fragile little thing in our minds that's constructed in our minds, the ego. And the ego is so immediate. It's like it has a direct connection to our primal brain, or you'll hear lizard brain, or that part of our brain that's so genetic that we're hardly conscious of the decisions it's making. You could say it's subconscious. You could say it's pre-conscious. You could say it's hardwired. But Buddhism would argue that no matter how hardwired something is, you can still influence it. But it's a good term to use to try to understand that it's not going to be easy to influence this thing that seems pre-programmed, is pre-programmed, with tendencies and conditions, and to somehow catch it as it rises into our conscious minds, and even if just for a moment, stop it, arrest it in motion, and say, let me take a good look at you from out here. Don't be in it, but be out here, and try to influence it. This is the whole game of Buddhism. And I don't mean game in a light way. I mean that this is how we engage our lives and make positive change to become happy human beings. So how does this relate to compassion? Well, everything I've said so far is about one person, you, me. Remember, when I say all of this thing, I'm no great authority who's saying, you must do this. I'm sharing what I've learned out of all my study and my own self-learning. And believe me, when I speak to you in this way, I'm including myself. So I'm not claiming any special ground here. Only if I'm claiming anything, that I've really focused a lot of years of study on this and I understand how this works. So if you're curious about how this works, I think I have something to offer, and I'm always open to your comments under the video. But let's continue. So compassion. This is advice that I would give to anyone in a relationship, man or woman, any kind of relationship, especially going into marriage. Because here's what happens. What I just explained to you, that ego. And I'm going to put a slide up. I'm going to show you what it looks like right here. And I have it here for my own reference. But I think I'm going to figure out how to post it on the slide. I don't know if you can follow all of that. But basically, I'm showing at the top here how the ego on one side is functioning next to our mind. It isn't the same thing. And our ego has different priorities than our mind does. Our mind is capable of cognitive reasoning, of being aware of what's going on around it. But as I said before, there's a busload of programming underneath our mind that's making a ton of decisions that when it finally becomes conscious in our mind, we're not aware that there's all this baggage attached to it. So we think we're responding to being clear-headed and understanding what's happening. But what we're not understanding is that even that understanding is completely colored and influenced by what's beneath it. So, sounds impossible, but the goal here is to be so aware that you're aware of that, and that you question every thought that comes to your conscious mind, and kind of put it through some, hopefully you have time, to put it through some litmus test, and go, well, where did that come from? Why do I think that way? What made me enjoy that? What made me horrified by that? And what made me just want to put gloves on and punch the hell out of that? Well, why did I all of a sudden, just as a thought came to my conscious mind, my body was already shaking and reacting and because that happened way ahead of you actually being conscious of what was creating all of that. And the idea is to become so aware, so intuitively looking at that, that you can actually take action. In other words, make a cause, make a new thought, make a new program, and say, oh, okay, when you do this, what you need to be considering is this. And that may not be the ultimate answer, but it's a beginning to positively influence something that's not bringing positive results in your life. You notice how I said that? Because it's not always bad, a negative thing that's coming up that you have to fight. Sometimes you believe you're doing something really good, and when in essence and in reality, you observe the results are negative. And you're like, why is that? I'm doing a good thing. Maybe, and this is the position, by looking deeper, more consideredly, meditating on that thought that you thought was a good thing, you will find that it's coming from a very polluted kind of thinking that's not reasonable, that's not useful. And then you'll understand that what you thought was a good thing to do was actually built upon a bunch of bad advice. The advice coming from your ego. That construct that's trying, your ego is so expert at protecting itself and finding ways to justify itself. It's so fast. It's blindingly fast. And it's happening before you're even conscious of it. So if I painted a picture at all today, I hope you get it. That this self-awareness isn't just words. It's not just, I know what I'm doing. No, you really don't. You know some of what you're doing, I'll grant you. Thank you for that. Even me, as I'm speaking to you now, I'm trying desperately to be as clear and honest about what this means. But it's also influenced by Sylvain Chamberlain, whatever that is, whatever that label is. My ego's here too. And I want to make sure it doesn't get in the way, because this message is so important. So, like the drawing here, I'm showing that feelings, you know, you ever notice how feelings just sort of pop up? You don't just sit down and go, I think I'm going to feel really angry at that thing right now. I feel like being angry at that door. You know, who does that? You know, but if you're walking out of the room and the back of your hand happens to slap the back of the edge of the door and this pain shoots up through your arm, for a moment there, you want to punch the door. Maybe not physically, but even if you're a gentle person, feelings will arise immediately. And you say, well, that's because I hurt myself. Listen to those words, I hurt myself. Why? Why did you? Maybe some part of you wanted the back of your hand to hit the edge of the door. Did you have a flashing thought about that? Was that just an effect of an action? Is that something you do a lot? You see the kind of questioning you have to put yourself through? It's very humbling, because you really have to let go of your knowledge that you know who you are. You have to really investigate to know who you are. Is ultimately who you are is your mind, not your ego. But the ego is hardwired in there, so you really got a wrestling match going. So what we tend to do, without even considering it any further, is a feeling will arise. Seems comes out of nowhere into our mind, and we'll feel some emotion about that feeling. Good, bad, indifferent, right? And that's how we construct in our mind another self. There's a lot of selves here. So you have your ego self, which you kind of just react to. And you have your mind self, which is built on top of that ego self. And that mind self is where we create our identity, who we think we are. It's in the words we use. It's fascinating. But what happens is when we take action from the ego route through our feelings and emotions, we're kind of at, we're vulnerable. We're leaving ourselves open for any consequence. Sometimes the consequence seems good. Oftentimes it's just fallout. Some good, some bad. Sometimes it's just bad. Sometimes it leads to greater conversation, and now we're back to relationships. And you say things and it explodes, and the other person comes back, and hopefully through both your egos you negotiate a middle ground, and your mind thinks, oh good, we're all right. But you're not. And the rate of marriage dissolution in this country should convince you that those battling egos, no matter how much our mind tries to negotiate a truce between those two battling egos, it's fake. It's fake because the egos haven't changed. You've just built this other layer on top of them. So in Buddhism, when we give advice to a couple that wants to be married, for instance, we have to have this talk. And we have to get the couple to understand that each of them has to be able to hear the other through the lens of, this is not me. And this is not you. But what you're saying, what you're doing, what I see you say, hear you say, and see you do, is a complex mixture of my mind and my ego looking for any opportunity to see vulnerability here. And a clue to what your ego is about. It's only a clue, though, because, again, it doesn't come directly from her ego or his ego. It comes from his ego mediated by his mind or her mind. So what you're hearing is a clue. You're hearing something that's built on something else. And if you can see all those layers interacting, ego through mind, through mind, through ego, ego through mind, to ego. There's an opportunity there to help one another. There's an opportunity there to say, I hear what you just said. Here's what I think I heard you say. It sounds like this. Is that what you're trying to say? That's the first level of negotiation. If both of you can be committed to at least doing that, you both have a chance of uncovering each other's ego drivers. But I'm going to tell you, that takes commitment. That takes a constant awareness that this is the game that's being played. And it's hard to stay aware of that because your ego doesn't want you to be aware of that. It just wants you to do what it wants. It's a petulant little creature, that ego. It will not accept defeat. It will not accept contradiction. And it will not accept change. But you're human. You have a huge mind capable of this whole world. And think of this, as important as your worldview is, and I mean me too, all of us, There are, right now, about 7 billion of us. I don't know if you can even fathom that. There's 350 million people in the United States. That's about a third of a billion. A third. Now multiply that by 7. It's just unfathomable how many people. But remember this. Each single one of those people, and we're only talking about humans now. We're not talking about all the other life forms. Just humans. Each one of us owns a complete universe. This planet, the moon, the sun, the stars, everything is mine. And yours is different. We think we're all in the same universe, all on the same planet. Yes, our actions do have impact on a common reality. I'm not loony, okay? But in our minds, the way we understand the world and the universe, that's absolutely unique to us. And guess where it's rooted? It's in that ego. So, talk about how different. Talk about how minuscule your world is compared to 7 billion competing worlds, universes. Can make you feel very small. But here's the other side of that. If you can imagine yourself constantly aware, even just a little bit aware, even pick a time of day. Okay, from 5 o'clock to 6 o'clock p.m. during dinner, we're going to be aware. Whatever it is you need to do. Buddhism is about a practice to help you get there. That's why we meditate. That's why we chant. To enliven and invoke that Buddha nature that already exists in us. It's built in us. Our Buddha nature is already here. It's in that ego too. It's in our thought. We're not built flawed. We're just built with bad filters, and that's part of the human condition. Those filters are our ego, but our ego also contains our Buddhahood, our absolute enlightenment, our complete awareness. So let's wake that one up. But do you see how, you know, all of this is very, Buddhism is so singularly practiced. It's a very individual practice, a very individual science about how we're built. And if you've heard the term Hinayana, small vehicle, early teachings of Buddhism were all about trying to grasp that idea alone. It's huge. But as you move on in the teachings to Mahayana Buddhism, if you go from trig to physics to quantum to cosmology, then it really gets tough. Because if you grasp just a little bit what it's like to watch your own pre-conscious ideas come into consciousness and arrest them and go, okay, we're going to analyze you. I can do that better. Oh, that's really nice. I need to keep. That's a keeper. That one's got to go. And if you can master that, forget master, just work on that. Add the complexity of now. Not only working on your own, but accepting a partnership with another human being to do it together, for each other, with ourselves. Whew, that's a lot of work. And that's why relationships are so tough. Because we very seldom spend any time thinking this way about our relationships. Our relationships are all about immediate gratification. All about our ego. Like Buddha likened it to a monkey. There's a lot of monkeys in India. And monkeys they don't know what they're doing one second to the next. They're jumping from branch to branch, hanging this arm, hanging upside down, throwing banana in their face, throwing their poo at somebody. They're all over the place. So the Buddha used that example to try to get people of his time to understand calming that monkey down, trying to get it not only calm, but to pay attention to what I'm saying to it. Hey, that's huge. That's almost unfathomable. Well, that's the battle we have, just ourselves, with our own ego. How many times have you said something with your feelings and your emotions, and it's just blah, blah, and you, your conscious mind is going, you're going to say that. I can't believe you actually came up with that. There it goes. It's in the air. You said it. And your conscious mind is going, oh no, what are you doing? Right? How many times is that? I know it's happened to me. And then we got to backpack. I'm sorry, I didn't mean, oh, and your ego is going, why are you apologizing? I so believed in that. And your conscious mind is going, you're making my stomach turn and it hurts, and but I have to take this back and shut up. Even without knowing it, our conscious mind is trying to retrain our ego. Unfortunately, it's too late. Buddhism is about getting there before the train leaves the station. It's like in martial arts. There's a theory in martial arts of watching your opponent. And I don't mean to make this a fight, but it can feel like a fight. The idea is that when your opponent commits to a movement, you see it and you move more quickly than your opponent with a response. It's called leave late, get there early. There's different ways to say it, but do you know what I'm saying? Leave last, get there first. Because if you leave last, you'll have the benefit of seeing the commitment of everything else. Now move so quickly that you can intervene before it can complete the opposition. It's very similar to the battle that our conscious mind has to play with our inner lizard brain, monkey mind, ego. And guess what ends up happening over time is that identity thing that your mind constructs of you starts to change. But here's the magic of it. I'm sorry, it's scientific, but for me it's a magical process, because as we learn more about our identity and develop our identity more accurately and more positively directed, other people's perception of our identity will also change. And our perception of their identities will change. And if you can focus this way just on the one intimate relationship you have, even if it's just yourself, you will begin to see other human beings, people you don't even know that are just walking past you in your environment. You will see them. Your vision, your perception, your idea of others will change. This is Buddhist compassion. This is empathy at a level that the dictionary doesn't provide. What is it, Chloe? Did you hear that? It's my little dog. She's like, Daddy, I don't get it. Well, you're a dog, but we'll work on it. Sorry about that. Yes, baby. Anyway, I think that's probably enough to get us started on this talk. I'm going to try to get this video together. Next up, I'll just give you a sneak peek. We're going to delve even deeper into what our perception is about and how that works. Okay? And I'm going to use, you see, E equals MC squared in there. We're going to talk about noumena and phenomena. But I think, you know, all of that is actually just derivative of what we talked about today. I'm including you in this conversation. I'm going to talk more about it because it's maddeningly complex as it is simple. Be hyper-conscious of your thoughts as they're forming, as they're acting, and stop them and consider them. You could say this is a description of meditation. You may just have to find some quiet time and sit and pick a thought, pick a decision you made today, pick a decision you're thinking of making, and just ponder it. Ponder it, why it exists, why it feels good, why it doesn't feel good. One thing's for sure, and this is a tool for your daily life. Anytime you can identify that you're taking action, And action means words, it means thoughts, and it means physical movement. Words, thoughts, the moment you take an action, if you can identify that the motivator for that action is emotional, it belongs to some sort of group of feelings, then you're on the right track, because you're identifying that your ego is pushing this, not your mind, not your clear Buddha mind. Something else is pushing you. And that should upset you. It should upset you that something else is driving the apple cart, not you. It should upset you that your ego is making your decisions for you instead of your conscious mind. We need to reverse that. We need the conscious mind to go, quiet down. Here's a banana. Shut up. Okay, what's really going on here? See, that's real happiness. That's what Buddhism is about. It's about leading a life of consciousness, of your mind properly influencing your actions, not your ego. Does that make sense? I hope I brought that down. Anyway, I hope that helps you. It helps me to talk, and I could talk about this 1,000 times and it would come out. None of these speeches, none of what I talk about is scripted. I like it that way, because I can catch my mind in the act. It helps me test myself and program myself. And I just feel like if I write this stuff down and then I start to read it, my ego is going to be jumping all over that thing and taking it apart. And then I'm going to say things that are going to be influenced by something else. And it won't be genuine. And I want this to be genuine. Buddhism is a person-to-person dialogue. And I'm kind of violating that by doing it in a video. But it's so important to get this information out. So I'm trying to make it as person-to-person, me and you, as I can. So I'm showing you my raw, unedited self. Anyway, I hope you have a really, really great day. I must stop on that, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.